This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is biographer, scholar, librettist, poet, Herbert Martin. And here's an opening poem. Here's Herbert.
His father taught him a few lessons. Although he never questioned once the underpinnings of his truths, he spoke about everything, riding the back of a segregated bus, drinking colored water, entering designated toilets to cast away personal waste. He had to learn to devise a plan to discover if the architecture of what he said was true. By the time he knew the answers, his father was dead.
The voice of Herbert Martin. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're together at the Library of Congress. Herb, I know that poem, and the one thing that struck me when I heard it the first time was how you changed a situation which was heartbreaking to one with a surprise, because the poem is a redemptive poem.
Thank you, yeah. I was hoping that it might be that. And, you know, the little story that I added things to it, but my father, once we were in the north, took me on a bus ride downtown, and I had just come from the south, and he got me on the bus, and I sat down in the back of the bus, and he came back, and he said, "You don't have to ride the back of the bus anymore." And I had to try and figure out if what he was saying was true, because I had heard for 12 years, you know, you have to go to the back of the bus and not cause any trouble. And so that's what I did. But once we were in the north, he didn't explain. And so I had to discover whether or not I could do this thing with no explanation at all, or no history or no reasoning or anything like that.
And before you could understand it, he was gone.
He was gone.
Dr. Herbert Woodward Martin. He's been associated with Paul Laurence Dunbar for many years. We're going to talk about a new book we're celebrating today. And he has collected the uncollected work of Dunbar in a book entitled In His Own Voice, Ohio University Press. But Herb is also many, many other things. Professor Emeritus, University of Dayton, librettist, a magnificent singer, and a poet of national acclaim. So we're going to try to cover a little of all of that. Since Paul Laurence Dunbar is in my hand, this beautiful book, In His Own Voice, where you collected things that had never been in print before, tell us who Paul Laurence Dunbar was.
Dunbar was born in 1872, and he died in 1906. So next year will be the centennial of his death. And so lots of things are beginning to happen. There'll be a conference in California. We will have one in Dayton. And I think in Dayton there will be a kind of year-long celebration. And I'm doing a kind of farewell performance of Paul Laurence Dunbar, because I've done it for 33 years.
A one-man show.
Yeah.
I thought
that would be the nice time to for me to retire from the show.
I doubt it.
Well, you know, 33 years, and I thought symbolically that's when Dunbar passed away, and so why not end it then? He was a very young man when he died.
I couldn't get over it. When I read this book, first of all, I want to thank you for the chronology in the front.
Oh.
Because
yeah.
I needed that.
Ah, okay.
I was in a maze, and I just loved the way you put exactly what he did and when he did it. Mm-hmm. That set the cornerstone for the book.
Sure.
But I could not believe that the man wrote for only 14 years.
That's right. And when you think he graduates high school at 18, and then he's dead within the next 14 years. And in that time, he wrote four novels, four books of short stories, and 12 books of poetry. And it's an incredible, you know, he must have been writing night and day.
Like you do.
Yeah,
like
I think so. Yeah.
And I would love to hear a little bit of Paul Laurence Dunbar, for which you are so famous.
Well, let me give you one of his, I think, prophetic poems. And this is called A Negro Love Song, and I think it anticipates rap. I seen my lady home last night. Jump back, honey, jump back. I held her hand and I squeezed it tight. Jump back, honey, jump back. I heard a sigh, a little sigh. I seen a light gleam from her eye and a smile go flitting by. Jump back, honey, jump back. I heard the wind blow through the pines. Jump back, honey, jump back. The mockingbird was a singing fine. Jump back, honey, jump back. And my heart was beating so when I reached my lady's dough that I couldn't bear to go. Jump back, honey, jump back. Now I put my arm around her waist. Jump back, honey, jump back. I raised her lips and took a taste. Jump back, honey, jump back. Love me, honey, love me true. Love me well as I love you. And she answered, "'Cause I do." Jump back, honey, jump back.
What a range your voice has. That's Herbert Martin, and he's reading Paul Laurence Dunbar, a very famous poem. You know, you bring up a whole panoply of difficulties in American letters with Dunbar. Would you, first of all, call him the father of African-American literature?
Well, he's certainly the first to be recognized in this country, born in this country of African-American parentage, and he manages to become a literary figure. And he is the first to use dialect in a way that I think expresses the black African-American humanity that was so long denied in the earlier works.
And yet, at the same time, that's a very double-edged sword for him.
Yes.
Because a lot of people did not see the satire, as you point out in the book, did not realize that he proved that he could write a play in grand English, 18th century English. You taught us that.
Sure.
And so dialect for him was a choice.
Yes. And part of that was because he heard the language used. And I think, you know, when we get back to it, we come to the roots that the language is spoken. And even the poems in early English were oral poems. And so a good deal of Dunbar comes from that oral sensibility.
But I know that you also have received criticism for reading poems in dialect.
Well, I think the black literati of the time really was afraid of dialect. And there's a little bit of dark cast and tinge to using dialect. It seems to suggest something second rate. And I think that that's why people like Du Bois did not want black people represented in dialect. He suggested to Langston Hughes that Hughes should not use vernacular speech at all. And so we get really those high standard English poems like The Negro Speaks of Rivers. But thank goodness Hughes didn't listen to him all the time.
And Sterling Brown.
Yes.
Also called.
And those are marvelous poems.
This is who he is. We're talking to Herbert Woodward Martin. And he has authored 6 books of poetry.
That's right.
Yes. And the last book is entitled The Log of the Vigilante. That won the Mellon Prize. That was a national award. And it was published in 2000. Then he won the Ohio Arts Council Governor's Award, and that's for outstanding service in the arts and also for teaching. He has his doctorate of humane letters by the University of Dayton, and he has received the Society for the Study of Midwestern Literature Mark Twain Award.
Yes.
Well given.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we're talking about In His Own Voice, the uncollected poems until this minute of Paul Laurence Dunbar, and we're going to hear some more. Here's Herbert.
Here's a very short poem called Theology by Dunbar. There is a heaven forever, day by day. The upward longing of my soul doth tell me so. There is a hell, I'm quite as sure, for pray, if there were not, where would my neighbors go?
What does he mean to you personally? I know professionally that you've dedicated a large part of your life to performing him and collecting him. As a poet, What does he mean to you?
Well, he was the first to go ahead and write. And like all of us, he was working as an elevator operator. But he got the sense and tuned into the fact that people were interested in his poetry. And so he wrote poetry on the side while he worked in the daytime. So in that sense, he's a kind of inspiration that one can get this done if you have this calling. You can do it, and you just have to work at it. You work at it 24/7.
I've seen you.
You know, and that's part of it. So I think I've told myself, if Dunbar could do it, perhaps I can do it too. So.
However, you admit that your early life was almost in an avoidance of Dunbar.
Yes, that's true, because I looked so much like him in childhood. And my peers all thought that I was related to this man, and therefore I should go home and tell him to tell the teacher not to make us memorize these poems. And I thought, I kept saying, I don't know him. He's not my relative. But
he was whispering in your ear.
Well, he was. And I had horn-rimmed glasses. I looked like him.
Wow.
And though I fought for many, many years to avoid him, and I did, I think, successfully sort of bury him in my heart. And it was Margaret Walker who brought him back to life when I ran the first Dunbar centennial of his birth in Dayton, Ohio in 72. And she read Dunbar with such exquisite flair that when she finished, the whole audience just stood all up at once. You would think one person was standing and they just cheered. And I thought, my goodness, I've got to go back and learn all that subtlety and all that music, all that joy, the humor, and the pathos, because it's all there.
And do you know what the word mission spells? That was your mission,
yeah,
and
that,
you have fulfilled it.
Yeah, well, Herbert, I hope so.
Herbert Woodward Martin. Let's have a little bit more of Dunbar.
Okay. Let me read you another prophetic poem. And this is called He Had His Dream. He had his dream, and all through life worked up to it through toil and strife. Afloat forever before his eyes, it colored for him all his skies, the storm cloud dark above his bark, the calm and listless vault of blue took on its hopeful hue. It tinctured every passing beam. He had his dream. He labored hard and failed at last. His sails, too weak to bear the blast, the raging tempest tore away and sent his beating bark astray. But what cared he for wind or sea? He said, "The tempest will be short. My bark will come to port." He saw through every cloud a gleam. He had his dream.
Oh, you need the right lungs to read that poem, though. You really do need to project that poem
sure,
the way you do.
Yeah.
You're a singer by trade, right?
Yeah, that's right.
It helps.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Herb Martin, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Herb, let's go back to one of your poems.
Okay.
You get equal time here.
Oh, well, that's awfully nice. Thank you. This comes from a little poem. There was a man in the neighborhood who fed all the wild cats in the neighborhood, or the stray cats. And then, of course, when he died, I began to wonder what was going to happen to all those cats. And so I wrote this poem called Neighbor. Spring is in you, gentle old Jew. You knew isolated hungers like no other communal stomach. Gentle sir, you gathered dispensable chicken parts, carefully cooked and seasoned them, then fed the tribe of cats at your back door. Gentle man, your house is empty now. The cats themselves are dispersed like the wind, searching for the unimaginable corners of your generous hand.
Herb Martin here. We're at the Library of Congress. That was his own poem. From what book?
Escape to the Promised Land.
Now that we are here, it seems so fitting, since I know that Paul Laurence Dunbar hangs out with you in spirit anyway, to say that he worked at the Library of Congress.
Yes, he worked here for several years.
As an assistant
as
in the reading room.
As an assistant in the reading room.
Did you visit the reading room today and see?
Yes, I did.
Uh-huh, but you've been here before.
Yes, but that was a nice thing to go and think, well, here I'm trying to touch this table, thinking he may have passed this way or done this thing here.
But he gave it up to write full time.
Yes, yeah. And then he went on tour to London, where he read for the royal heads. And Ambassador A at the time took him under his wings and made sure that he got to read for as many important people in London as possible.
Boy, that's lucky,
yeah,
isn't it?
That was just sheer luck.
I know. Well, we cannot know what reputation will be remaining after us.
That's
we
right.
don't know what posthumously anybody will be,
sure,
really.
Yeah.
And so do you feel that a circumstance could have had it otherwise for him? That he could have been not known by the American public?
It could have been, but I think he had a few nice little strokes of luck along the way. His second book got sent to William Dean Howells, who was, by the way, friends with Mark Twain. And Howells reviews Dunbar's book in 1898 in Harper's Weekly. And he says, this is the first African-American born in this country of African-American parentage to exhibit literary talent. And that made Dunbar a household name. And from that point on, everybody knew who he was. And he was able to sell the dialect poems rather rapidly, not able to sell the standard English poems as quickly. And so I think ultimately he said, I think that Mr. Howells has done me an irreparable harm. I've come to believe that Howells made it possible for him to have an American reputation, and had Howells ignored him, he would have struggled on for many, many more years. And given the fact that he had such a short life, it's a good thing that Howells said what he said.
How old was he when he died?
33.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Let's hear something else from Paul Lawrence Dunbar. Herb Martin is our guest, and he is an authority, maybe the world authority on Dunbar.
Well, I hope not. Here is Dunbar's most famous poem, and it's called We Wear the Mask. We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. This debt we pay to human guile. With torn and bleeding hearts we smile and mouth with myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise in counting all our tears and sighs? Nay, let them only see us while we wear the mask. We smile, but, O great Christ, our cries to thee from tortured souls arise. We sing, but, O, the clay is vile beneath our feet and long the mile. But let the world dream otherwise. We wear the mask.
Do you suppose that poetry is in public domain?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. All of his poems now are in public domain. And I found a number of them, but and they are all really quite lovely pieces, which means that I'm happy to read them.
Herbert Martin is our biographer, scholar, poet, librettist, musician, the favorite of many poets, his peers who love and revere him. And actually, you know more than anybody I know. I have sat on a panel with you when people will say, who began the sonnet, and all of us are scratching our heads, and Herbert said, I think Petrarch. You know, so you are really trained, you're a classically
yeah.
trained man.
Sure.
And so you come at your art on many levels.
On many. Well, you know, one of the things that I remember, I sat one afternoon with Alan Tate, and he said to me, because I was very young, he said, you know, you have to recognize the old guys as well as the new guys. And so pick some old guys. And when I heard Dunbar, I picked him. But, you know, it meant going back and looking at a lot of poems. And I had some pretty good teachers when I was in high school and in college. And I read a lot. And my friends who were, you know, aspiring writers and poets as well, if we came across a poet who did remarkable things, we couldn't wait to show that poem to all of our peers. Say, look at how he did this with this comma here, or look at what he did with that period, or look what he did when he enjammed the line. And it was that kind of excitement that always kept me going.
Mm. And it still does. Yeah. Herb Martin, I'm Grace Cavalieri. Are you going to give us a little more Dunbar?
Sure. This is a lovely poem about a grandson, I think, and a grandmother. And it is called Opportunity. Granny is gone a-visitin'. Oh, I seen her get her shawl when I was hiding down there behind the garden wall. I seen her put her bonnet on. I seen her tie them strings, and I is gone to dreamin' about them cakes and things on the shelf behind the door. Oh, mercy, what a feast. Soon as she gets out of sight, I can eat in peace. 'Cause I've been watching for a week just here for this here chance. And when I gets in there, I is surely gonna dance. Oh, lemon pie and ginger cake. Let me set and think. Vinegar and sugar too. Now that's gonna make me a fine, fine drink. And if there is one thing that I love most particularly, it is eating sweet things, honey. And drinking sangaree. Lord, won't poor Granny rare when she see the chef. When I thinks about her face, now I is most ashamed of myself. Well, she is gone, and here I is back behind the door. Look here, my granny expected me. There ain't no sweets no more. Every sweet is hid away. Job is done up just brown. Person would have thought that somebody thought that there was thieves around. Oh, that just breaks my heart in two. Oh, how bad I feel just to believe that my own Grandma believed that I would up and steal.
Herbert Woodward Martin, and there isn't another person like him in this world. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Tell us about the detective work that it took. Just very briefly, how many years did it take to put together his work?
It took about 12 years. I found Herrick, which is written in 18th century comedic standard British English rather than American English.
And is there anything else published that shows that quality of his writing?
No. Oh. The other plays are completely lost. We don't know what happened to the other three plays. But I think that with this play, he really was trying to work himself out of that dialect corner that he found himself painted in.
And you see in your book, in his own voice, you have given much evidence of the fact that he was a virtuoso.
Yes.
And the poem, The Lonely Hunter,
yes,
is like Yeats.
Yes.
So I'm so happy that you showed other facets of him.
Yeah, he has a marvelous range, you know.
I know. It's like the criticism of him is unfair.
Yeah.
And it's like Pound said of Sandburg, cruelly said, little Latin and less Greek.
Yes.
But you know, Herb, you have enough. You have the Latin and you have the Greek. And he had a classical training,
yes,
too.
Yes, he did. When he graduated from high school, somebody had promised money to go to college, but they backed out. And so he took a job and worked as an elevator operator. And that's how he published his first book, Oak and Ivy. All the copies were for a dollar and a quarter, but he paid $125 for that first edition, which sold out. And then it did so well that he published Majors and Minors, and that's the book that landed on William Dean Howells' desk.
So the message here is the world will only believe in you if you believe in you first?
I would think so. I would think so.
And he proved that.
And he proved that. Mm-hmm. He went to work and proved it.
That would be a lesson learned for us.
Sure.
For everyone.
Yeah. Yes.
This is The Poet, the poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Herbert Woodward Martin. We are celebrating the book In His Own Voice, And we are celebrating Dr. Martin as well, because he is a poet who is known and loved and beloved by other poets. Now, that's the acid test. It's what other poets think of you that ultimately matters quite a bit,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah. It is.
I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are back. We're at the Library of Congress. We're with Herbert Martin. And we're going to switch gears now. We're going to leave Paul Laurence Dunbar alone for a moment and go into your own canon of work, which embodies about 6 books and one more coming. Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of interested in the librettos because I don't know them. You have written 3 librettos.
Yes, I've written 3 opera librettos, and I am in fact trying to pull the 4th one out of my brain.
Is that Magnificat?
No, that one will be called The Last Tsar, and it will be based on the Romanovs. I have it all in my head, and the poor composer, he must be ready to kill me. But I've got to pull that out of my head and put it on paper for him.
Okay, we have to start right here, because I know that you have written an oratorio.
Yes, okay.
What's an oratorio?
An oratorio is like the Messiah. It's with arias, recitatives, and choruses.
So you write the words?
Yeah, and you write I write the words, and the composer writes the music. The first opera I did was Common Ground, Paul Laurence Dunbar, and that was an opera I did with Adolphus Hale Stork in 1995.
Was it good?
I think so.
Could it
in
go
fact,
back?
In fact, the critics said it was too short, but he liked or she liked what we had written, and I think it's going to be done again in the centennial of his death year.
Where might that be?
In Dayton, I know. Mm. The Dayton Opera Society is going to do it. And there may be other performances because the music and everything has gone off to the publishers, so people can rent the copies and produce it.
So that was your first venture?
That was my first venture.
And what was the second?
The second one was a complete text for an opera called It Pays to Advertise. And it's a comic opera between a husband and a wife. One's a lawyer and one is an advertising executive. And they get into an argument over who can do the other person's job best.
Has it been produced?
It's been produced and performed. And as you might gather, neither one can do the other one's work as well. And they have to admit it. And that's the twist. Then I did a Magnificat, which is based on Mary's announcement from the angels, or the announcement to Mary that she is with child. And after that, next one will be Crispus Attucks, the cantata, and it is set for soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, and chorus.
You really have to be a musicologist, a musician, and a poet to do that.
Well, yeah, or you have to learn the craft and then figure out how those things go together.
And who's your composer this time?
Adolphus Hale Stork is the composer for the cantata this time. For the second opera, it was Philip Carl Magnusson, which always makes me think of one of the Bach sons, who was named Carl Philip Emanuel.
Are you easy to work with?
I think so. You know why? It's because I won't quibble with the composer over a word or over a syllable. And if they hear it without the extra syllable, I say, don't call me up in the middle of the night. Just change it.
Yeah. You know? The collaboration is something that is a gift.
Yeah.
And if that gift is not working, mm-hmm. nothing happens.
Nothing happens. And I just figure it's not... it's not worth it to fight over a syllable when, if I'm going to publish that text anyway, I can put it back the way I want it.
You're the last one.
And so it doesn't, you know, I think, why should this person have to suffer because he's trying to set all of those syllables? They should have that freedom. And then just tell me.
Herbert Martin, and I'm Grace Cavalieri, and he's telling us a few things today. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're going to hear some of Herb's own voice, in his own voice this time. Now, what book are we looking at?
We're looking at Escape to the Promised Land.
Mm.
And I would like to read this because it's very close to my heart, I think. It's called Painful Laughter. It must have been this way when Roland Hayes first sang in Germany. What the literati thought, what can this black man do with our sacred leader? Then he floated effortlessly the enchanting melodies of Schubert's Du bist du Ruh. From his dark lips, an unexpected torrential downpour of Rückert's cool summer words flooded the walls, and they began to reverberate. Surprise was forever etched on the tongues of those in the audience, who began to cheer and cheer and cheer this brown man who came from the southern clay and cotton of Curryville, Georgia. What did they know? What did they know about the birth of song, or in what soil it could take root?
Oh, that is a lovely last line. Can we hear that one again? Yeah. What did they know?
What did they know? What did they know about the birth of song, or in what soil it could take root?
May I speak to the music in that, please?
Sure.
And do you know the vowels there are absolutely Herbert Martin quintessential writing, because they just roll out. Born to be sung.
Thank you.
Those are lyrics born to be sung.
Thank you. That's nice. Because you don't, when you're writing the poems, you certainly don't know if it's going to work. And you hope that you have all the little pieces there.
Music is more important to you than most, though, because some people have different things going on in their poems.
Mm-hmm,
some
mm-hmm.
different dynamics, mm-hmm. and some people like different things.
Sure.
But you, if it doesn't have music, you don't want to dance to it.
Yeah.
In fact, when I sent you something of mine, you noticed the music in it. And that was the first
sure.
thing. That's what you're about.
You know, I'm hearing that because I'm thinking, if there's no other way to figure out, you need to hear the musical phrase in the line. And that will teach you about how to set the line down on the page. And so then you can tell your readers to read to the end of the line. They don't have to go da-dum, 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 da-ding, da-dum, 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 da-ding, because that gets kind of boring. And so they can figure another way into the line and out of the line and
riding
make sense
along,
out of it.
Riding along
yes,
with it.
Yes, yes.
We're riding along with Herbert, and I'm glad. Herbert Woodward Martin. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is some more of Herb's work.
Here is a poem based on the photographs by Walker Evans. Walker Evans, Alabama, cotton tenant farmer's wife, 1936, from Mark and Marianne Callahan. She has made what she could out of this life. It is spare. She bites her lips, perhaps tastes her own blood, and knows she will endure. It looks as if the wind has worn away her beauty, as it has torn away the paint from their clapboard dwelling. It is the desolate 30s. The land has long since turned from yielding cotton. She has Modigliani eyes. They cut through. They look forward. The time is spent for this brief picture-taking. She will make what she can for dinner and hold on to what love she has in Alabama.
You took that from a photograph.
Yes.
That's a very good exercise for students, isn't
it? Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you think you don't have any ideas, go to the library and get a book of photographs and go through and let the photograph talk to you.
Wonderful.
And then see what it is in terms of the details you can describe.
William Carlos Williams,
yes.
Pictures from Bruegel.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that's all he did was
yes.
go to look at those paintings by Bruegel.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
Let's move on with you.
Okay. A second one. Walker Evans, Alabama Tenant Farmer, 1936. There was once hope in my eyes, as fresh as my newborn's cries. She is my survivor. She will break free from the thinness of dimes, from the dirt which has insinuated its way past skin, blood, and bone to some deeper place where even the soul has not thought to go. My daughter is my last gamble. She will free me from these hills. She is my way out. I have turned the land for the very last time. I can do no more, nor hope that this marketable year will turn more plentiful profit. In the late night, when the house breathes silence, I taste my wife's subtlety, her passion, while she can still taste the sun in my pores. A stone is in me which is blind to that which I once called hope.
Powerful ending.
Thank you.
To end with that one word. What is the name of this book again?
This is called Escape to the Promised Land.
And give us the publisher.
Bottom Dog Press from Huron, Ohio.
Ohio.
Yes.
Yeah, we should list the literary giants who have come from Ohio. Sure. Herbert Woodward Martin tops the list. Rita Dove.
Yes.
Stanley Plumley.
Plumley.
Sherwood Anderson.
Zane Grey.
James Wright. And many
more. Yes.
What does the Midwest do for you?
Well, it's allowed me the space to see things. It's allowed me the space to write. And so I've had a pretty good life growing up there and bumping into the poets that populate that area.
You were not born in Ohio.
No, I was born in Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And we migrated when I was 12 and a half to Ohio. And I remember thinking as they put me on the train by myself and I came to Ohio. And as we left Alabama, the conductor came through at some point and he said, "We have just now crossed the Mason and Dixie line." And I said to myself, "And that's that."
Have you written that yet?
No, I haven't.
That is a poem right here and now.
Oh.
What a wonderful closing. What a curtain line.
Yes.
And that's that. And that was it.
Yeah,
you never looked back.
It. I never looked back. And it's kind of interesting. Though what I did do was after many, many years when I was uncomfortable, I started to open the curtains of all those 12 years. And I began to write poems about those experiences. But for the longest time, it took me, I think maybe 15 to 20 years, I did not part that curtain and write anything about Alabama at all.
There's your next book,
yeah.
Parting the Curtain.
Yes.
Because that anecdote on the train, when you cross the Mason-Dixon line, and as a youngster, you
yes.
had a sense to say, that's that.
That's that, yeah. And I didn't know why.
Where did
you know,
get that word?
I had no idea, except that the people in the family were always really kind of clever with language.
Uh-huh.
And so I must have heard it. And of course, when that moment happened, and I've always remembered saying, and that's that.
That must be recorded.
Yes.
We will give you till midnight.
Okay,
Herb Martin.
Okay.
And let's have some more Herb Martin. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress. We're having a very, very good time, as you can tell.
This poem is called Breath, and we can explain what it's all about later. Breath. When the Dalai Lama dies, the monks immediately began their arduous search of locating his breath descendant, the child who was born at the precise second the revered man ceases to breathe. It is always the hope that they have found the divine alive and still breathing, so that there never occurs an interim in his reign.
We need to talk about breath.
Sure.
Tell me about that significance in that poem.
Well, I think it's important that what they do is, when the Dalai Lama dies, they make a worldwide search of finding the child that's born exactly the second. They calculate it to the minute by going around and searching hospitals to find that child. And then that child is reared as the next important Dalai Lama, so that there's one exhales and the child who inhales becomes the next Dalai Lama. So there's never an interim or interregnum in the reign. The Dalai Lama just keeps going and going and going.
Oh, that is, you know, fascinating.
And I think I like that idea, because when we have when the Pope dies, we have to have that period of mourning, and then we have to have the period of election. And so there is a kind of space in between. And I think that kind of passing of the torch, passing of the reins, or passing of the religious power doesn't happen when you have the Dalai Lama. And
it's so interesting, because I've been thinking about, you know, breath is, I think, one of the ancient roots of the word, mm-hmm. is the voice of God.
Sure.
And the essence of God. Mm-hmm. And that's why the breath that is in each of us,
yeah.
is inherited. For instance, Robert Pinsky believes that we have a column of air inside of us, and we can read Walt Whitman, mm-hmm. and we are bringing forth that ancestry.
Sure.
So breath is such a holy thing.
It is.
And I never understood that, the way that happened, until I heard that poem.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have another poem.
Here is a poem. A student asked me why I wrote this poem. It's called Appropriate Words for Mourning, MOURNING, for Pablo Neruda. The rain begs at the palings of the wagon. The wagon sheds the rain. The wheels carve deeper roads through the rock and mud, which are soon flushed with water. The neighbors come out of their houses one by one, carrying grief as a flower. Pain is what they know. It is a familiar friend. Silence is an imposition of law. Still, it cannot shackle eye or ear, for the town knows what it needs to know and will say what it must through the fiction of their blood and the breath of poems. Neither man nor woman passes away without someone knowing, and that is why these citizens have assembled and follow the fateful rain into the local cemetery, where all the solemn umbrellas weep as they place this man in the earth.
That has such a crescendo. That poem is written to, like a wave which rises in the yeah. air, and then it just falls.
Yes.
That
yeah.
is a poem yeah. that has a lot of power behind
Thank you.
It.
Thank you.
This book has a lot of power behind it, because there are so many different kinds of things in this book.
Mm-hmm.
You have a dialect poem mm-hmm. in there, and you have high rhetoric in
yes.
this poem. You have a classical poem,
mm-hmm.
and you have character studies.
Sure.
You have situation comedies, and I think it gives a little bit of everything you have.
Sure.
All your books.
Again, I'm trying to show, like Dunbar, that I have a range, and I'm not just given to writing one kind of poem, that I can do many, many things. And I try to do them just to see if I can be successful at them.
I have seen you do many venturesome things. One, stand on a stage with a screen behind you, which has two forms of poetry, which you read back and forth. It's very experimental. And it is, I guess, a cantata.
Yeah. It's a contrapuntal poem. And what I've done is I've stolen the idea from J.S. Bach, whereby you would invent a melody, and then you can turn that melody upside down, and you can write a fugue on that melody. And so what I thought was maybe if you could do that with a choir singing, SATB, then you could do the same thing with two people reading against each other. And so I've tried to make the poem work down the page, and then, because nobody's ever said that you can't do it, make the poem work up the page.
And you play both parts.
Yes.
And that's Herb Martin talking. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I also want to tell everyone, I have seen him stand on a stage where 3,000 people stood up and gave him a standing ovation. Is that the truth, Herbert?
That is the truth.
How do you like it?
It's frightening, because you look out and you see all these people standing up and you think, why are they doing that? And you can't know why, because one can never step outside of one's own body and see whether or not those people have been moved. You can only hope that they've been moved.
I've seen it happen. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're going to listen to Herb Martin.
Since you mentioned the dialect poem, I will read you this one. It's called Lord Child. It had another title, My Mother's Voice. I done told you a million times, Lord Child, that them words you's fooling around with don't make no sense. Them words is the devil's work. You better leave 'em alone, you hear? Here you sit from morning to night, writing down what you think is right. Whoever told you you had the right to decide bad and good? It ain't worth the time of day, unless it's gonna bring you some silver, and I don't see how it's possible for anybody to be paying you for something you done scribbled down like chicken scratch. And don't go telling me nothing about what or how much money white people make. You ain't white, and I don't want to hear nothing about no fame. Attention ain't no good when you're dead. Don't make no sense, and furthermore, it don't make no never mind how much you scream or how long and woolly you let your hair grow or how many baths you refuse to take. If you ain't got no money, you ain't got nothing to say, and I didn't have to go to no fool college to learn that. I done been walking through this world and learning since I knowed exactly who I was. So if I tell you that a hen dips snuff, search for the box. Boy, where is you going? I'm talking to you. You better come back here and listen. Lord, Lord, these children are gonna be the death of us all. Not that we ain't giving them plenty of kindling wood.
If the hand searches for snuff, you better find the box.
Yes. No, it's if I tell you that a hen dips snuff, search for the box.
So it's like meaning a chicken. If I say it, though,
it's true.
You better believe it.
Yes, absolutely.
And how did you learn that, Herbert Martin?
Well, I learned that from listening to the ladies in the family chastise us, you know. They would say, you better listen to that. I'm telling you what you need to know to go out and live in the world. And so I thought, well, maybe I better listen to them. And so I sort of stole their voices and put them in poems. And my mother said once when I read this, I know that poem's supposed to be about me, but it's not.
I love the story about your mother who was ill.
Yes.
And she could not write her name at the end of her life.
Yes.
And it hurt her very much to write. They said to just write an X.
Yeah.
Write an X.
Yes.
And that insulted her.
Yeah.
And so after, I have to tell the audience this because we haven't gotten to it. After the doctor left and she could not quite manage the line in her name and she did the X, she was so mad. She said, I can write my name. And she took your book and she scribbled her name on every page, every page.
She just wrote it and wrote it until all the anger disappeared. And that was my workbook. But she said, give me your notebook. And I gave it to her and give me a pencil. And she wrote her name out and her name out. And I thought about that years later and I thought, why couldn't I just let her write her name and then white out the line underneath and just draw in another line underneath her handwriting. It would have been so simple.
But you did. But you know what? This poem, which is permanent forever,
yes,
has been the same thing,
yes,
as whiting out the mistake, mm-hmm, and making it right.
Yes.
That poem makes, yeah, everything right.
Yeah.
It's a good thing about poems.
Yes, it is. It is. It can speak to you in many ways.
Herbert, let's have another. You seem to be favoring this book. Is it because it's your new book?
It's the newest book, and
they always are the best.
Well, I don't know. You've written, what you think you've done is given, put your best foot forward, and so you want to do that one. The poem I'm going to read started out as a ballad, and it started out as an exercise for R&B, which is really research and bibliography. So I'm glad I'm reading it in the Library of Congress. But then the poem said, that's not how I ought to be. I ought to be something different. And so I rewrote it, and it's called now The Washerwoman's Fire, and there's two poems out there. My immigrant mother cooked her white clothes alive. From dawn to five, she boiled them, turned them over. Then she removed them and said, you must whip the dirt from your clothes if you want them to be clean. Then she rinsed them twice and hung them facing Southtown. There were sheets and pillowcases, ruffles, ties and silks and laces. Every Monday morning, my father built her iron pot a fire, then filled it with water. Carrying water is a tall command for a small daughter. The fire seemed always there. So did the pot. On my natal day, June 6, 1845, a spark reached beyond that pot and caught a ride on a derelict piece of paper. It was a hungry wind which carried that torch like a human passion. It stirred the entire community. It left a trail as it began to eat the dry grasses, then the wood frames which shaped the houses. Soon, Southtown was all aflame. The fire was quick, abidingly quick. It grew to full life in an hour. From diamond to wood to Water Street, smoke and wind were the fears you most likely would meet. The losses were certain. The deaths were finally tallied and assured. A lunching wind, an enormous fireball, swirled around a fireman and burned him through to the blood. A delicate old woman who refused to leave her home knelt down in a private place, and all that was left were a gathering of bones fused together. When evening came, the fire settled gently, the cinders smoldered. Now, when I have cause to remember that special day, I think of what a sudden ordering that fire made of Southtown, celebrating my 7th birthday.
Whoa, that's action-adventure poem.
Yes.
And that was starting as a ballad?
It started as a ballad, and I started out in 1845.
Tell us what a ballad is.
It can be a four-line quatrain stanza and rhyme A, B, A, B. And it has to have, I think, either an iambic tetrameter rhythm or an iambic pentameter rhythm. So if it's tetrameter, it's oompa, 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 oompa. And if it's pentameter, it's five. Oompa, 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 oompa.
Ask him anything.
And you have to have that rhythm.
Ask him anything. And I don't have to be afraid for a minute that he won't answer it.
Oh, well, that's awfully nice of you. That's awfully
ballad.
Nice.
That's
you.
A ballad.
Yeah, that's a ballad.
I never heard it really described that way.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's have another ballad or not.
Oh, okay.
And this book can be gotten, right?
Yes, this book can be gotten. I'm thinking this is, it's Escape to the Promised Land.
And Bottom Dog Press is in Ohio. You can just look it up on
right.
the internet.
That's
we
right.
can't give prices here, but we can send
sure.
people in the right direction.
Yes. This is called Advertisement. Subtitle, Husband Wanted. None but those with the following refined qualities need apply. You must possess the ability to tickle silk. You need not possess the static cling of electricity. You must be willing to love any woman named Julianne Pizza and enter her life with hat in hand, preferably riding a palomino of distinguished breed, vowing to be a party to everything the horse is inclined to do. You must hate zits and do everything possible to eradicate them from the body politic. You must love bubblegum and children on hot blue days as well as those days which are exactly opposite because I am a woman who requires it. I do not wish to present myself as niggling on the subject. I want to be clear and non-deceptive. Otherwise, there would be no wisdom whatsoever in my having paid for this advertisement.
And with so much going on, Harmony.com on television and all of these places on the computer that put people together, that I wonder what that would bring in, Herbert.
Yeah, I wonder too.
That's you at your mischievous.
Yes, it is. It is.
Yeah. And we're going to have a final poem.
Would you? Okay. This is called Black Villanelle. There was a time when the black men ate first because the field work demanded a full stomach. We children always held our laughter and silence under the strict moratorium of our mother's eye, lest we unwittingly disturbed our father's sleep. That was the time when the old men ate first, while our secondary stomachs whined and complained. The justice of the scraps were left for us to consume, like children who always held their laughter and silence because the times required it. We needed to be quiet. Whatever was necessary, the young men brought it home, for that was the time when the working men ate first. As persuasive as ever, our joyous voices made noise outside of the house, in the yards and streets, careful as children who always held their laughter and silence. Our voices could raise the roof of a black sky and not betray a child who had never understood that this was a time when the black men ate first, like children who always held their laughter and silence.
The voice of Herbert Martin. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Associate producers are Ken Flynn and Mike Turpin. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. The Witter Binner series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art, and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. You can hear this series on www.loc.gov/poetry. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.